Welcome to the Men of Eight Gang podcast for Saturday, March 28th, 2009. I'm Steve Borsch, and on is Graham Thickens.
Hello.
Tim Elliott.
Good morning.
And Phil Wilson.
What, no music?
You know, I looked for music this morning, and honestly, it was just too much of a challenge. So
I missed the banjo.
You missed the banjo? Oh, man.
Well, everybody's going to have banjo music in their life.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I actually know a guy who plays a mean banjo. We could have him on live sometime.
Okay, here's one from Comic Twit. What's a phrase that you never hear?
I don't know.
Is that the banjo player's Porsche?
That's good. I like that. I'm going to steal that.
But what's the definition of optimism?
I don't know.
A banjo player with a beeper.
With a beep. Oh.
Actually, you know what I was going to start with this morning? I was going to start with this.
That's
all right.
How do you stop this crazy thing?
All right, let's get cranked up here. You know, it's really fascinating to me that there is so much discussion. There's so many ideas going on about saving newspapers. And I remember, I can't remember exactly the content and the points you made, Tim, sorry, in your post about this exact subject. I did one, too, about blogs. But a guy that I met at the social media breakfast connected me up with a guy named Bruce Bennett, who had been with the Strib or is somehow involved with the Strib, and asked if I'd be interested in, you know, being pinged about ideas for the Strib saving itself. I said, sure. Yeah. You know, I've got no shortage of ideas, because the newspaper guild at the Star Tribune, reporters and editors are trying to crowdsource ideas for saving the newspaper.
Yeah, I think that they basically asked to get out of the print business. And, you know, that's going to be a tough one to get their head around, unfortunately. But that's the only way that I can see that they can actually, you know, have a viable business on the other side.
So when you say save newspapers, you mean more than just for recycling. You're talking about saving newspapers as a business.
You're saying? Fish wrappers.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Unfortunately, the newspapers think they're in the newspaper business, and they're really in the news business. And mm-hmm. Of course, the news isn't going anywhere. It's going online, and it's gone online and electronic, and people want to consume it that way. So, you know, you're seeing all these newspapers go down because the management is doing all the wrong things to make their product less attractive to the audience, which is, you know, they lay off newsroom people. So they're basically, you know, taking their content engine away, which people want, and they're trying to figure out, okay, how do we make this thing into a business? And I just don't see print newspapers being with us for, you know, more than 3 or 4 more years, really. I mean, there'll be a few of them left, but I don't think that they will be here in the metro and in many metro areas of the country.
You know, you just said something, Tim, that just sparked a thought when you said that management's doing, you know, all these different things and so on. You guys know Clayton Christensen, the Harvard Yep. Business School prof, Innovator's Dilemma, Innovator's Solution. I remember the first time I really heard him was he was speaking at an open source conference talking about open source as a disruptor. And he had all these great stories, you know, about how Sony delivered solid state, and the vacuum tube manufacturers were just not understanding that their business was going away. And he talked about how disruption goes through those three phases, where it's crappy, it's less crappy, and then it's good enough. And when it hits good enough, that's the tipping point. And then he brings all these other analogies, like DEC, and how DEC with a mini computer did all the right things. He said their management, when they came out with, you know, whatever model mini computer it was supposed to be the be-all, end-all. And what they didn't understand was that they were competing with workstations that were, you know, 10x cheaper than the mini computer. And they just didn't understand that that was disrupting the business. And they priced the mini computer at the right price and did it for their customers and all that. But of course, it was all for naught. And I'm wondering if exactly, well, I'm not wondering. I believe that exactly the same thing is going on, where just like the railroads didn't really realize that they're in the transportation business, not the railroad business. Same thing with newspapers, just like you said, Tim.
Yeah, I think so anyway.
Well, yeah, local news still has value. And I think these news organizations, if we can call them that instead of newspapers, need to understand, you know, how they can provide something of value, differentiated value, and charge for it. I mean, I think we're back to the subscription model. It's the only viable solution. I mean, I think they've found that advertising is not going to support the costs of their news organizations, online advertising. It's just not growing fast enough to save them. And now we're hearing that even online advertising, as fast as it has been growing on a percentage basis, is slowing. And, you know, the shift is definitely going more towards subscription models than it is to advertising. Advertising startups or startups that are based on gaining revenues from advertising are not getting the attention they were getting from VCs. That the tide is shifting there. But the best piece I saw, I sent you guys this morning, was in the Wall Street Journal about a month ago, called "Information Wants to Be Expensive."
Yep.
Which is the second half of the "Information Wants to Be Free" quote that everyone loves to throw around, that Stuart Brand came up with back in the 90s or whenever it was. He made the point that, you know, that information, of course, it wants to be free because of the, you know, the commoditization of technologies that allow information to spread on the internet. But this guy who wrote the piece in the Wall Street Journal, and he's the Dow Jones executive who was responsible for turning the Wall Street Journal into a successful online model, he said that, Stuart Brand, when saying information wants to be expensive, is, that information in today's complex economy and society can make a huge difference in our professional and personal lives, and having this information can make a difference if someone else, you know, if you don't have it, it can really make a difference in your life too. So online is a great way to value this information. And he even cites in this article a couple of local newspapers that have successfully charged for online access. There's one in Arkansas, of all places, yeah. The Democrat Gazette, and he also cites Hong Kong's South China Morning Post.
Hey, read that every Saturday.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, there are, but the point is, there are, you know, it's not impossible, even though there are some that would have you believe that, you know, papers like the Star Tribune could never charge for that. Well, yeah, you know, I don't think that's necessarily true. I think it's unfortunate that for 10 years they, or whatever it is, they have been providing it for free. But, you know, maybe guys like our local sports columnist, Patrick Royce, who's been railing at this for years, you know, why are they giving it away? You know, maybe he was right. never should have been.
Well, okay. But, you know, the question that was in this Wall Street Journal article, that's also this Bill Bennett is all over as well, is it's not about saving newspapers or magazines. It's about saving journalism.
Right.
You know, I've got an issue right here in Eden Prairie with Flying Cloud Airport that they're trying to extend it. And Phil, you remember when we went to that new pamphleteers conference?
Yeah.
You know, before I signed up for that, or as I signed up for it, I didn't know what the hell a new pamphleteer was until I started to dig in and realize that, oh, this was before newspapers, when the colonies were here and people would go and, you know, whatever they were hot on, they were like the podcasters of the day. They could go and just print up a pamphlet and hand it out. And it was newspapers that became the first aggregators.
Right.
Well, you know, it's the this flying cloud airport thing is one. When we were at that conference, I ran into a woman that had been a producer at CBS at 60 Minutes. And somehow we talked about the value of journalism and investigative journalism specifically. And I mentioned that they're extending the runway and all that. And she just said, I just have to stop you. And she went on about how they had been digging into this story where all of these, kind of the cobble of FAA and airline and Metropolitan Airport Commissions and all of that were trying to figure out ways to extend airports so they could shove all the commercial or the non-commercial traffic to these smaller airports, which, of course, will be horrible for us living just, stone's throw from flying cloud. And yet, I don't have the time to go dig into that story and maybe spend a month, full time digging it up. I would love it if there were a way to, do an Amazon Mechanical Turk where you could break up a story into its discrete parts and give me a little chunk and give Phil a little chunk. And, you guys have an airport in Lakeville, Tim, so give you a little chunk and go out and, spend a few hours digging into something. But it's all about journalism, not newspapers.
And that's why I think that the business model won't be either all advertising or all subscription. There'll be a kind of a fusion, like how TiVo does their model, where you pay a subscription fee on a monthly basis, but they also sell analytics and they sell sponsorships for people to have videos pushed down that pipe. So there's going to be this kind of thing on either side, because it costs money to actually produce the content that people want.
Absolutely.
Well, it does. I mean, these news organizations, particularly those that are set up to do investigative journalism, it's an expensive proposition. And I don't know about trying to break it up into bite-sized pieces. It still takes people investing their time. And, are they going to do that for nothing? I mean, it really comes down to, news gathering, and particularly investigative journalism, is hard work. It's very time intensive. And, who's going to pay for it? And are citizen journalists just going to go out and do this out of, of their own free will and without being compensated for it? I'm not seeing that, happen in a big way. I mean, stuff.
Well, there's definitely a segment of the population that will do that. I mean, because they feel it is a civic duty. And I found that interesting in that article that you forwarded off, Steve, about the Strib and what they're going to do. I mean, they even the people behind the effort are saying, we do it because it's our, it's our civic duty, and we do it, because we're, it's our responsibility. Well, a lot of times that sort of stuff's not paid for. I mean, that's if you feel like it's your civic duty, then, looking for compensation is almost, verboten.
Yeah, but wait a minute, Phil. These are guys that belong to unions that are getting pretty decent salaries and big fat benefits,
So yeah,
it's awfully easy for them to say it's their civic duty, but they're getting paid well for it, too.
Exactly.
And they have been up till now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue that the citizen journalists have always talked about. That was the main point of the pamphleteers conference that we went to, Steve, is, right. How do we monetize this? How do we make money? Because clearly there's a desire to have local information provided to you, whatever that level is. And there is a desire to have news provided to you. But who's going to pay for it when there's a gazillion different places you can get the news?
Well, I think the local news, though, is hard to get in a gazillion places, and that's where the action is. Local people like Steve in Eden Prairie and many others, I think, are willing to pay for information that relates to their own personal lives and their own personal neighborhoods. And I think that's what needs to be cranked up, is more of these localized news organizations figuring out how to get people who are willing to pay for it to, in fact, sign up. And
well, but that's the issue. Nobody right now is willing to pay for it. Yes, they like to hear what's going on in their community. Yeah, sure, they would love to know that. But if it comes down to saying, well, it's going to cost you $5 a month.
Well, I
just
don't
say,
know
that, I'm not going to do that.
I don't know that nobody is, though, because, even the Sun newspapers here locally, if it still exists under that name, they actually charge people in Bloomington for that thing. And they still produce it. I mean, they don't provide it for free. So there are people that will pay for these local newspapers. We don't hear a lot about it because it's not major media, but and then, you know, we read about sites like this newspaper down in Arkansas that's charging locally for online only, apparently. And it is happening, I think, you know, and I think people are willing to pay for that local news that they can't get from the wire services or whatever online. You know, it's stuff that the AP and whatever are never going to be reporting on. You know, they're not going to be sending somebody to the Eden Prairie City Council meeting, you know.
Well, and the thing is, if you buy the premise that a newspaper is an aggregator of pamphleteers starting back in the, you know, the early days of our country, and that the, you know, I mean, if you pick up the Star Tribune, you know, 5 years ago, I never counted this and quantified it, but I would guess 40 to 50% of the content in there was news service or other newspaper articles that were just collated and aggregated and published. And then, yes, I mean, obviously the big stories were local content and so forth, but it's been interesting because now that I've gotten to talk with Joel Kramer at MinnPost, because we cross-post at MinnPost, used to run, you know, the Star Tribune, talking about journalism, doing the same thing with Reed Johnson, who is the CEO at Internet Broadcasting, about why he should, I was sort of pitching him on why he should embrace user-generated content. All these people pretty much poo-poo that idea as though there isn't anyone else but an educated, experienced journalist who can actually report the news or find the story and, you know, and so forth. And, you know, back in February of 08, I did this post about why newspapers need blog networks. And it was really sparked by Scott Karp at Publishing 2.0, who had discussed the same thing earlier, that, you know, what if they became blog networks where, you know, they would have, you know, ask Tim Elliott, you know, you can make money if you run the Lakeville blog, and Phil, you know, you can run whatever, and Graham, Bloomington and I, Eden Prairie or whatever. And it's our responsibility to follow the guidelines and go out and find people who can produce and deliver content. And yeah, they would get, you know, create a monetization scheme downstream. But then the Strib, as the parent site, as the paper, would be able to aggregate all that and cherry pick stories from different parts of the metro area or even Minnesota at large. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's just one idea. I'm sure everybody's got, you know, some idea, but that keeps it local and it also creates this distribution channel. But again, it puts them in the position of doing what they do best, which is being an aggregator and editing and, you know, doing story assignments and things of that nature.
I totally agree. I think it's going that way. And I think the professional journalists and the, you know, the dyed-in-the-wool older generation guys are slowly coming to the realization that, you know, maybe you don't have to be a professional journalist trained with degrees and so forth to be able to do basic news gathering and reporting. And I think they're going to be going more towards the blogging community. I mean, I think we're seeing that more and more all the time. And, you know, look at all the folks that are leaving the news business, whether they're getting laid off or choosing to leave, they're going off and doing their own blogs. And, you know, many of those that are professionally trained journalists are have become bloggers. And I think that many non-trained journalists have proven that they can write and yep. they can critically think and examine a topic or certainly at least report, you know, relatively in an unbiased way what's going on out there. And so the newest organizations, I think, are going to have to be going towards more of the so-called quote unquote citizen journalism. But it's the key is figuring out how to compensate these people, getting some monetization scheme going like you refer to.
Well, I in my post, I kind of talked about an Engadget-like model, which is, you know, basically freelancers and you pay per post and maybe you have something based upon the amount of comments and or the amount of traffic to that post. since it's tied directly with what you can get from a ad, you know, that's placed on the side.
So how do you set a standard of credibility if you're aggregating a whole bunch of different people? I mean, you know, who do they answer to as far as fact checking and that sort of thing? If the newspaper is really just an aggregator of freelance journalists?
Well, I think it falls to the editor. You know, the editor who was assigning these people, I think, has to serve that role and has to, you know, communicate with his news gatherers and set some basic guidelines. I don't know if you guys saw the New York Times blogging rules that was published this last week.
No.
Oh, they've got some pretty strict ones. And of course, you know, they have to. And of course, they were just lambasted by independent bloggers that thought it was a bunch of crap. You know, a lot of them did, but still a news organization has a brand to uphold, and you know, whether it's the Star Tribune or the New York Times or whatever, the editors there are going to have to impose some sorts of guidelines, and fact checking is huge. It's a huge thing, Phil. You're exactly right. There are news organizations that employ people that do nothing but fact checking. That's all they do all day long. They're checking on things. I'll give you an example. The local Twin Cities Business Magazine, you know, they largely rely on freelancers to write their stories. But they have people down there that are doing nothing all day long but checking what these freelancers are saying in their submitted pieces. And they want to make sure that they don't go out and say something that isn't true. And so independent fact checkers is probably a career with growth prospects in the media business. It won't be a high paying job, but you know, it's generally interns. It's intern kind of work, but I think the editors have to rely on the independent journalists and have to teach them to do the right things before they submit something, you know.
Well, what do you think about the Strib doing their breaking news, their news break thing with Jim Lilics? I know that there were a lot of people, and I kind of did as well, sort of ridiculed, you know, the approach. But
what are they doing?
Well,
what exactly?
Whether if you go to StarTribune.com/video, they do they do essentially video news stories, but they also have a news desk. It's called Newsbreak, and they do a kind of an overview of the late breaking stories. And I was just sort of puzzled when I first saw that, as I thought, now, wait a minute. The whole point of reading a newspaper is to get the depth and breadth of a story. If I want to just see, you know, headlines and sound bites or be exposed mm-hmm. to that, I'll turn on one of the local news channels.
Mm-hmm.
But I read the newspaper, or I, you know, dig into stories online because I want to get, you know, kind of a 360-degree view of a topic or an issue.
And so they've got Lilics on camera just doing news bites, you mean, like headlines?
Yeah, just reading stories. He's sitting there in a suit, you know, with a tie.
No kidding.
Yeah,
well, I love Lilics. I mean,
yeah,
he's,
so
the guy's a real personality. He's also a huge Mac freak, which is how I originally met him, standing
In
line for the latest Mac about 10 years ago. But I must say I've not gone and looked at that. I do love reading his column, though, in the print Star Tribune, which I still do subscribe to. But yeah, why would they do that? It's almost like they're trying to compete with the local TV stations.
Yeah. And rather than ridicule them, though, as I in some ways want to applaud the risk, you know,
yeah.
and the fact that
they're
doing something, they're trying, they're
exactly
putting themselves out there.
Yeah, good for them. They got to try a lot of things, you know, and yeah, whatever works. And he happens to be a big draw, I think. So, you know.
Well, excuse me for just jumping in here, but there's an email. I don't know if you guys have received it from Minnesota.com.
And yes.
From some guy named Sepp. Well, I sent him an email and said, you know, I would be interested, but I want to know who you are. I wanted mm-hmm. to have some background on who, you know, because if it's just like some guys overseas or something that are doing it, that's one thing. But they're essentially building a directory. And I find that to be really fascinating. So it's not just a you know, city by city directory, but it's also a blog directory. And I look at something like this and I ask myself the question, why hasn't the Star Tribune done this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why haven't they put together a destination site that competes with the phone books or the Yellow Pages or Craigslist? You know, build a destination site where people want to come and participate, and it's the first place they go to look something up.
Now, it's interesting. You're talking like it's a more than just a blogger directory. I read it where, at least at the start here, it's really just a directory of bloggers who happen to live in the state of Minnesota. But is it more than that, huh?
Oh, I mean, they've got a whole listing of businesses.
Okay. I missed that part because I didn't know who the guy was. And, you know, he's asking me to put a link on my blog back to him. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm a tech blog, you know, and I only partially blog about Minnesota anyway. Why, you know, I too didn't see what was in it for me, or I also didn't know who he was. But I tried to ask him, okay, how much did you have to pay for Minnesota.com? But he wouldn't tell me. But he hasn't owned it since the beginning. He acquired it at some point along the way. But who he is and where he is, I have no idea.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's an interesting concept. I don't think it's very well executed. I see Garrick Van Buren's First Crack podcast on here.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, but, you know, it's not even alphabetized. There's no way to search and sort. And
you're kidding.
Yeah, so it's a little, it's clumsy. I mean, you can search the whole thing at the top, but you can't go specifically into the blog directory and search for a blog directory or a specific blog or by topic. So it's not, you know, it's not very well executed. But the point is,
why didn't the Star Tribune do it?
Why didn't the Star Tribune do it? I mean, if they're an aggregator, why don't they say what today is really inefficient that would be of benefit to have something local and something that would attract people to it and make it a fundamental part of what they do?
Yep. Well, it almost makes me think of back in the 90s when the St. Paul Pioneer Press went and snagged TwinCities.com. And they saw the value early on of trying to be a total resource for the entire Twin Cities Metro. And they still use that domain to this day.
Right.
I don't know that what they're doing is necessarily all the right things either. Although I think it's fair to say that they aren't in bankruptcy and they seem to be growing circulation over there across the river. So more power to them, but I don't think they're yet charging for online access either.
Phil, somehow, do you see any analogs with respect to risk within the radio business? Is anybody locally doing anything that you look at and say, it's an interesting experiment?
You know, I don't really see a lot of it right now. And, you know, I think anybody that takes risks or is taking risks or trying new things in radio mostly falls to Minnesota Public Radio. I think that they're trying some things and between their public insight journalism efforts to some of their online gaming and that sort of thing. They're trying a lot of different things to involve people in the news. To see, is it profitable or is it a good business move? It's hard to say. I mean, it because of the nonprofit nature of public radio. But yeah, there is some, but it's not coming from the commercial sector. The commercial sector is still clinging to an ad model.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So
right.
Other than NPR, and again, to some extent, National Public Radio and American Public Media are trying some good stuff.
Well, and here was just a quick segue, and I know we're running out of time here pretty quickly, but I really, frankly, enjoyed writing this article about Fallon releasing Skimmer, that social web app.
Yeah, can I ask you about that, Steve?
Real
quickly. Is that really more of a promotional tool for Fallon to just introduce to their clients to get them involved in the web? Or are they going to build that out more?
What, you didn't read the post?
Well, I did, but it was like, I couldn't quite figure out where they were going with it.
He skimmed it.
skimmed it.
You're a skimmer. Jeez, Phil. Well, you know what? I mean, the entire, they're walking the talk. Their entire premise is this branded generosity. And so they're trying to show that they're not just paying lip service to the strategy, but rather, you know, living it by putting this thing of value out into the marketplace. And so I look at that, you know, again, with respect to...
I got from the article, Steve, but I didn't get the feeling, were they going to do anything more with it? Are they going to build that app out?
Well, they're going to, yeah, they've got a roadmap and they're going to add some more features. I'm sure they're going to bring in other services. But
because, I mean, they've got the really basic services, but I was curious about things like, are they going to allow us to you know, aggregate our own, you know, URLs and that sort of thing?
I didn't ask that specifically. I didn't ask what was on the roadmap. And
see, I was asking. See, I read the article.
Okay, all right. I'll let you off the hook. Jeez. Well, the whole point, though, is again, coming back to the Strib, is why isn't the Strib delivered an iPhone app? Why haven't they delivered a rich internet app like this that's an aggregated thing?
Simple. It's really simple. It's the same problem that all media has. I need to monetize it now.
Right.
That's the whole thing. Most media organizations are so tied to an advertising model and so tied to, you know,
the
short term, yeah. They don't have working capital to invest in the future. They just don't have it anymore.
Okay. Well, you know what? I mean, here's something interesting that I came to last night when my wife and I were watching this, watching Hulu on our new Mac Mini Media Center.
Oh,
I had to throw that in. I know. I'm goofing on it. That's great.
He's either been writing an article or doing this media center, ladies and gentlemen. The man right. does not get out. He's got this pasty complexion now.
That's right. Well, that's because bags of cash, UPS comes and bags of cash are just placed on my doorstep. I don't have to do any. But in all seriousness, we're watching Hulu and my wife, I showed her how to use the keyboard on the Bluetooth keyboard to use the arrows to go fast forward or in reverse. And an ad came up and the ads are only 30 seconds. She says, can I fast forward through that? And I said, no, they don't allow that. And all of a sudden the light bulb went on and I went, oh my God, today it's a 30 second commercial. You cannot scroll through fast. Tomorrow it's 5. Just like TV. Mm-hmm. And I realized that's the puppy dog close. I'm going to give you the puppy and then come back the next day and take it away from your family. And there's not a chance you're going to give that up. And that's what I thought was just an absolutely fascinating strategy around this.
It all comes back for full circle to it's the business of free. You know, we've built this business on giving stuff away. And now it's like, oh, wait a minute. We're giving so much stuff away that we're killing the paid models. Great. But how do we replace the revenue that we've just killed off?
Yeah. Yeah.
So if they're smart, they're going to have a free version of that. So the trade-off is that you watch the commercials on Hulu or whatever. But if you want the Hulu Pro account, you know, you pay them
the subscription model,
$19.95 a month, and you get, you know, no ads or something.
Exactly.
Yeah,
you know, it's really kind of like
people would choose that.
I think that we all hoped cable would be that, you know, there would be less commercials on cable because I'm paying a subscription model.
Right.
But as it turns out, you know, cable made so much money because they've got subscription and advertising sales. So,
well, but the value proposition of cable is different. It's that you have, you know, better quality picture and sound, but also you have more choice than
right.
just getting over the air stuff.
More choice of channels with more
of
commercials.
Programming.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
More commercials.
Right? Well, but if you look at it, you pay, you know, if you pay for HBO, there's no commercials in HBO. Well, I mean, there are HBO commercials there, but there's no commercials for Coke on HBO. So you're actually paying that premium, so there's no commercials.
Yeah, but you're also talking about a fairly limited repertoire of content, too, from HBO. I mean, admittedly, there's plenty of content to fill 24 hours, but if you look at original content, there's not that much comparatively.
It's not worth paying for. We let it go a long time ago.
Right. Right. I think that the services, the aggregation services like a Hulu will clearly are a model that people will pay for.
Yeah,
I think they will.
Well, and I love Comcast on demand, which is great. But it's slow and it's cumbersome and there's not a lot on there. I mean, there's a fair amount, but I gotta tell you, going into Hulu with this media center and scrolling down and looking at all the shows, and then, oh my God, The Time Tunnel, which was a show that came out in 1968, and my friend Danny Larkin and I saw the previews and just about fell off our chairs. We were so excited for this show to come. And I watched the first episode of it, and it brought back just this flood of memories from being a little kid watching this show. And, first of all, I didn't even know it was out there, but also, who the hell would put that on an on-demand system? I mean, who's going to watch The Time Tunnel? So the point, though, is that you can provide access to all the long-tail stuff you want in that model, and in the cable model, it doesn't really fly.
Right. It works in on-demand, but it doesn't work in a channel-based system.
Correct.
Because there's just not enough audience there.
Right. Exactly. But in the aggregate, again, there's an audience.
Yeah. No, I think television is going on demand, and it's going not only, on the TV, but also on mobile devices. So you can, start a program on your TV with your media center and then have it synced to your iPod or iPhone or whatever to watch, later. So that's sort of this media agility thing that I think is going on, which is the future of video and probably the future of news as well.
Well, and look at what the New York Times did with blogrunner.com, essentially build a tech meme for every category. And again, it gets back to that aggregation model. So rather than say, hey, guys, here's a news reader, you go out and find all your subscriptions in all these categories. You go out and find who the top stories are and who the most conversations are around. And you go off and do that all that work. Well, just a few percent of us are going to do that. No one else has time. No one else has the interest. They want to be presented. They want to just have access to it and let somebody else who's smarter or more knowledgeable about the category to go out and make those decisions and aggregate it together and present it. And I thought that was a great risk on the part of the New York Times to do that. So,
well, guys, they need to do something. I read where their valuation is now lower
than what
Market Watches was when it was acquired by Dow Jones.
Ooh,
that kind of brings it home, doesn't it?
No kidding. No kidding. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, another one in the can. Thank you.
Listen, I just sitting here, the computer open, and it's popped up that the social media breakfast site, the Ning site, has been spammed by Yajaira Welch.
Yeah, I got one of those.
I got one too.
She's got some ringtones for me.
Ringtones, exactly.
I just saw a little tweet from Rick Mann that said he's taking it off the site. So I was talking to somebody this morning at coffee. He said, you really ought to join us for social media breakfast. And I brought up the site, and there was Yajaira. And I'm thinking, wow. And he goes, hey, I'm there.
Yeah, she's good looking. But I was going to say, we're getting popular when the spammers find us. But we've had, 13 monthly meetings now? I just read online where the San Francisco social media breakfast is just on their second. I thought, how can that possibly be? We're that far ahead of the rest of the country,
Wow.
It means we all have to get out more.
Maybe
we're just more organized.
Listen, if you guys, I just deleted spam before we started the podcast, and I now have 7. So listen, if you need a new satellite dish, Insomnia Cures, Spring Recipes, Maybelline, or Viagra, let me know. Can you believe this stuff still works? I mean, it's got to work. Somebody's clicking on this, or they would have given up a long time ago.
There's no doubt about it. I think it's all 14-year-old boys.
Phil,
Viagra, really?
Oh, God. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You too.
Take care. Cheers.